And this is the time on a Friday morning when we're joined by David Tarachuk. David is the PBS television correspondent working with us ever really since we've been on the air. He reports on PBS on ethics and belief. He also has his own website called themediabeat.us. And we're thrilled to have him here every Friday morning as we take a look at the media and the media coverage of events around not only this country but the world. Good morning, David.
Good morning. Good to be with you. Joining you from, as ever, as most times at least, from the media capital of the world, New York City. It's good to be with the ever astute Marshall Miles again.
You know what? I sit here and over the past 2 weeks, I have seen so much information that conflicts with one another, and this time not from only social media, but from the health authorities in this country, the CDC saying one thing, the FDA saying another thing. Do you think the media is doing a good job covering this, or is there just so much information and misinformation?
Well, it's hard to judge. It's certainly a little like standing in front of a fire hydrant and getting this gush heading towards you. One of the useful things that a really good media service would do is help us with that gush. Do some sorting out, do some filtering, do some directional work with finding the stuff that's really worth our catching, if you like, if that's not a mixture of metaphors. If we tread carefully, if we make our choices wisely, if you turn, for instance, and I would urge listeners to do this, to turn to your trusted sources, and if they're the kind of trusted sources they should be, they will be doing that sorting out for you. On the specific issue of COVID, I turn to the Atlantic magazine. Their science team, journalists, are a particularly sharp breed, it seems to me, and they've got a very good way of dealing with very complicated issues, very complicated scientific matters, in a way that makes things very clear. Other people might have their own favorites. The New York Times, I think, is doing a pretty good job on COVID as a whole, and every now and again they'll do a specific takeout on the specific issue of, say, vaccines or immunity in general, or sometimes they'll take a look at the variants. Those two, I would name those two, and you might have your own choices for where you find that gush information, somewhat refined and carefully streamed in a way that makes greater sense and might be oversimplifying things at times, but boy, we need that sometimes.
Yeah, I sit here and I ask that question because as someone who is at that age, the CDC now recommends people for at-risk situations and for senior citizens for the booster, and now there's also a recommendation that senior citizens take this this special shot for the flu this year, which is stronger. And so I'm sitting here trying to filter all this out, when I'm going to take my booster and if and when I'm going to take my pneumonia shot. And, you know, it's just become more confusing than it has been in the past. Maybe it's just because I'm getting older, I'm getting a little less impatient.
But I don't think so, Marshall. I think there's a lot of information to sift through. That's the problem. One basic thing is clear, though. After all the huffing and puffing over the booster for Pfizer, we now have a pretty clear indication of who's getting it and who will get it. And after 6 months, of course, following the second one, some uncertainty does enter the picture, though, when you look at the other major American vaccines, Moderna and the Johnson & Johnson. The data has not been processed yet on either of those major vaccines, and I mean, it looks as if, for instance, I'm a Moderna case, and it's just not known yet when the approval for a similar approach as to the one adopted with Pfizer will be taken, as it looks like it will be taken with Moderna, and in due course with Johnson & Johnson too, though of course in Johnson & Johnson's case you're dealing with a booster which is just the second one, because the main vaccine is of course only a one shot in the first place.
All right, we'll change something, go back to January 6th, something that I think the media as a whole has handled extremely well. The select committee investigating that now has subpoenaed four aides to the former president, Mark Meadows, Dan Scavino, Kash Patel, and Steve Bannon. And they were all in touch with the White House on January 6th, and they're being subpoenaed.
Yeah, the critical... Well, one critical strand of the investigation, of course, is the role played by the White House, or, as Joe Biden constantly says, the previous guy. We know he addressed a crowd and said that they would all be walking down to Capitol Hill, and he said, "I will be with you." Well, of course, he wasn't with them. He was sitting in the White House, sitting in the White House, he was taking many phone calls, and these calls, which any self-respecting investigation would be interested in following through and investigating carefully. So it's a classic piece of connecting the dots, like any sensible investigation would be doing. And so, you know, the inevitably, just as it would be if it were a criminal investigation, of course, a congressional committee investigation is never quite the same. It will always be tinged with politics, and we can't get away from it. This is a highly politicized issue. But rather like the criminal investigation, you get to see what the investigators are most interested in from what and which witnesses they call. And to subpoena them just is another indication that clearly these investigators mean business.
And I have to turn my eyes to another story, and that is the gun violence. And in today's frenetic news industry, once again in Tennessee, that grocery store shooting, one woman killed, 14 injured, and the only thing that really protected the higher death toll is that people locked themselves inside of freezers. We just live in just such a strange world right now.
Well, it's not changed. This is one of the features, I'm afraid, of the American landscape. And it's an awful thing to say, but this is just all too common. The frequency of mass shootings is something that you and I have talked about this quite a lot. Other nations in the world look on this as some kind of strange societal aberration, and yet we just live with it. Week after week after week after week, and it, you know, it's interesting just to look at that particular story. In many many times it would be a cause for extraordinary concentration of coverage, and of course it's almost like a flash in the pan. We move on. Eventually, I guess, the nation will come to its senses, but maybe that's a forlorn hope given how many of such incidents we have lived through, and nothing changes. I mean, there is a ritual dance after them, and even while the NRA has been greatly affected by internal dissension and accusations of financial corruption, it's still a force. And certainly the ritual dance that happens after an event like this, when people, including NRA people and people who benefit enormously from the political donations of NRA, in fact owe their political position to those donations in many ways, will express inevitable regret for the loss of human life. The words thoughts and prayers will come up again, and then nothing happens. Nothing legislatively happens, and it does. I mean, if ever a societal problem called out for thoroughgoing legislation, this is it. And will we ever see it? I think is a terribly open question. Because one of the things that is, inevitably true about the role of the media in American political life is that spasms of horrific events and the horrific imagery that go with them are what in jerks and, as I say, spasms of a kind will bring about change. But it's very hard to say in the thrash of them happening whether they will be lasting at all. One can say, for instance, just to take one really important topic of the moment, that there's bad news and really bad images for the Biden administration at the moment about the migration issue, because the really bad news and really bad images are really piling up for the administration as a reward for continuing the previous administration's use of COVID measures to block migrants entering the country, and now to even forcibly return them one airplane load after another back to the place that many of them have come from, and that's the horrifying mess that is Haiti. It's got to the point where a highly principled State Department diplomat, Daniel Foote, he was recently appointed a special envoy to Haiti, has now resigned in protest against his own government's policy. It's interesting, as a sort of low-key figure in his own way of operating. He didn't grandstand it, though he wrote some blistering words to the Secretary of State, and his letter was initially quoted in a not exactly well-known website of a think tank, the Center for Economic and Policy Research, and then my own television program, the PBS NewsHour, quoted from it Thursday. But it was a blistering set of condemnatory words. It was how did he put it? He said, "I will not be associated with the United States' inhumane, counterproductive decision to deport thousands of Haitian refugees and illegal immigrants to Haiti, a country where American officials are confined to secure compounds because of the danger posed by armed gangs." Now, that's something for a public servant to do. That it's quite extraordinary, but it's set against optics. I mean, to use that terribly overused media word, that were already bad enough for the Biden administration when the Reuters agency journalists and a team from Al Jazeera too captured pictures of the U.S. Border Patrol officers rounding up men who were evidently Haitian at the latest epicenter of this problem, the large makeshift camp at Del Rio, Texas. The officers were seen on horseback charging the men and whipping them, if not with actual whips, then for sure with their long, loose leather reins. And there was a big misstep, media misstep, in which the Homeland Security Secretary, Alejandro Mayorkas, tried to justify the overall policy at the border now, and especially at Del Rio. The impact of those terrible visuals sank in, and he very quickly announced that he was, guess what, setting up an investigation into the officers. The footage, he said, is extremely troubling, by which time I imagine he must have obviously seen the footage. So we now get the kind of outrage which might lead to some changes. The Biden administration's record in its short time in office on migration has been extremely unsteady, and maybe this will be forcing it into taking some broad and meaningful steps for immigration reform.
I want to slide out of the United States for just a second, and I was watching the BBC early this morning when I got up, and a senior Taliban official, the soft and gentle Taliban is now a thing of the past. Executions have returned, according to senior Taliban officials. Extreme punishments and executions, amputations, once again, to stop the protests and also protests that are going on in prisons.
I'm afraid it's no surprise, is it? Yes, the obligatory efforts by the Taliban to present themselves as something different from what they were in the 1990s and right up until they were deposed in the late 2001 they are now obviously revealed as just that, obligatory efforts to ingratiate themselves with the world community. It's no surprise, and of course the position of women in Afghanistan is quite clearly getting returned to exactly the horrible state that it was in that previous period of Taliban being in authority, and you know, we can only in a way figuratively shrug our shoulders and say, well, what did we expect? I think at times the international community, led by the United States itself, you know, covered with its own embarrassment about the mess involved in its own exit, were having to say things like, we insist, well, with what force, I wonder, we insist that the Taliban set up an inclusive form of government. Well, we've seen what that involved. It doesn't essentially involve anybody except Taliban people, and Taliban people in the main of the most extreme bent, and it's working out in practice just as the worst fears suggested that it were. Perhaps not the very worst fears, but certainly very considerable deep fears have proven to be entirely justified, and women themselves in Afghanistan have no doubt about what the overall shift means, and you know, many are simply just not showing up for the work that they had before, and not being seen in public in the way that they were, you know, at least for in the urban parts of Afghanistan, able to do until the American and rest of NATO's terrible, terrible exit from the country. By the way, this is UN week in New York City here. That time when the U.S. press wakes up institutionally again to America having a role in the wider world. I mean, it's there all the time, of course, but it gets this institutional attention in September every year when the General Assembly meets and the very top leaders of the rest of the world come to join us. It still isn't clear at the UN, which is some kind of indication, I think, who actually speaks for Afghanistan. The Taliban has sent the official letter requesting that they be the ones who occupy the seat at the UN. It's still being discussed. That's the word from just down the road. I'm a few blocks from the United Nations building as I speak, and it's going to the Committee of Credentials. But I can guarantee you that the decision will not be taken this week. We will not be seeing a Taliban spokesman taking the podium amongst all of the world's top leaders this week. I believe that the committee to discuss the matter won't even meet until the very last day, next Monday that is, of the top leaders' speeches from that famous podium with the green marble background.
You know, whenever I think of that podium, I think of Yasser Arafat when he spoke there for the first time. and he raised his arms, and there underneath his left arm was a holster with a pistol in it. I keep flashing back to that scene. The UN is a very interesting place. It's a great idea. I don't know if its time is still is still current with us, with the divisions we have, especially in this country. But I want to go on to another country that is interesting. And once again, this story came from a foreign news source, and that is what's going on in North Korea, where Kim Jong-un's sister is responding to South Korea. South Korea is calling for an end to the official war, and she calls it a possibility if hostile policies are entered in. The leadership in North Korea, it's a strange set of leadership in North Korea, and you just don't know what to expect out of it, because you have one Kim Jong-un who has killed his own family members to be where he is, and his sister takes time to speak out now.
Sure. The most reclusive leadership in the entire world. That's probably no exaggeration. And it's very hard to read how it goes. It's an enclosed society, separated off in so many ways. To read the runes, as it were, you've got to go back to the skills that were employed for many years in the Cold War with reading what's going on in the Kremlin. Kremlinology was the term for the science, the pseudoscience that was practiced then. And knowing exactly what's going on with the Kim family is really difficult. Some people claim to be quite expert at it. And there are a few people, recent escapees is probably a reasonable enough description of them, are our usual source for what's going on at the top of North Korea. And the family dimensions of it are really interesting, as you say. The sister is clearly gaining more and more influence, and at the same time, the man himself, serial murderer, as you're quite right to point out, he's had as a career path to the top, and at the top, dealing with what he sees as threats from even within his own family, murdering people in other nations' airports. He's being quiet at some times, and other times dropping hints that he would want to talk again. And of course, the situation has changed entirely from when he could command world attention by the dramatic photo opportunities, essentially, of meeting with the former guy, President Trump, in melodramatic encounters that, of course, led nowhere, and we're left with a hanging situation now. We're suspended in something like disbelief, and certainly very little information on which to base any sense of how things might be going.
And I want to bring this up because it's a local thing that's here in Connecticut that you probably don't know about, a lot of people don't know about. But right now, out in Arizona, finally, a bipartisan commission has completely taken that other commission that tried to do a recount and said that, no, Biden lost in Maricopa County, and that's it. But now, here's when I bring this up for this very reason. This morning in the Republican American, this is how the way the presidential election has affected us across the country. We see lots of states changing their voting laws. We see lots of misinformation. But here in Connecticut, and this is the effect that's so dangerous about what Donald Trump has done, leaders of Waterbury's Republican and Independent parties are now crying foul and saying that there's something wrong going on. Why? Because the city plans to mail out absentee ballot applications to all registered voters in advance of the municipal election. It brings the problem home even on a local level.
Sure. It's infectious amongst Republicans, the idea that the voting system is somehow unreliable. And indeed, at the core of that is a suggestion believed by, you know, tens of millions of Americans that the November 2020 election was somehow stolen from Donald Trump. But the interesting thing, as you say, in Maricopa County in Arizona, is that over 2 million ballots cast in that election have been recounted in this extraordinary operation funded by right-wing donors and conducted by a highly suspect and very unprofessional set of so-called counters. They have come to the conclusion that the vote is almost exactly what how it was recorded back in last November. Just to throw in an interesting detail, they discovered that Joe Biden got 99 votes more than was reported back in last November, while Trump received 261 fewer votes than that county recorded back in November 2020. So you would think, that's a dangerous phrase in American political journalism, you would think that the issue would fizzle now, because all the effort put into that Arizona recount has come to naught, if you believed that somehow the election was stolen there. Will that change things elsewhere? I doubt it. I think with the dark money that is available to fund such an effort all over the country. By the way, the money for the Arizona recount didn't come from people in Arizona. We looked to places like Nevada for the financial sources. And if it happens in Connecticut, it'll be because of this infectiousness, this myth has gained. And if you want to talk about misinformation, as we did when we started this segment today, that's one of the classic cases of misinformation gaining ground, because it gets constantly reported in a way that almost takes it seriously. But almost taking it seriously is enough to have those flames fanned, and people who are predisposed to believe this ridiculous notion, for which there is again and again, it is proven, no actual evidence, we will find people demanding that recounts be held in their locality too.
David, it's always great to speak to you on a Friday. We'll speak to you again next week. Have a great week.
You too.
David Tarachuk with the Media Beat here on Robinhood Radio, robinhoodradio.com on the web.